Well, maybe you have read Pilgrim's Progress. How many of you have read this book before? Pilgrim's Progress. If you haven't read it, you really do need to read it. There are updated versions. There is the old classic version. It was written by a man named John Bunyan. He was a preacher. I think he was a Baptist preacher. And he was in England. He was imprisoned for his faith, for preaching the Bible. And it was in prison that he wrote the story of a man that he called Christian. And it's a pretend story that illustrates the challenges and struggles of the Christian life. And the end goal of the book is that this man, Pilgrim or Christian, I forget which name it is, and then there's a subsequent book about his wife, Christiana, are on the path to the celestial city. And the celestial city, of course, represents heaven and eternity. This is one of the well-known renderings of that part of the story. Well, John Bunyan, who wrote this, wants to represent heaven, wants to draw our attention to it. And as two pilgrims are walking along the way to the celestial city, one of them in the story asks the other, "When do you find yourself in your most wholesome and most vigorous spiritual state?" And what he's saying is, when do you find that you are doing the best spiritually? When are you in the right frame of mind? And the other man answered, "When I think of the place to which I'm going." And I don't think we do that enough. By that simple little point in dialogue along the way, John Bunyan emphasizes the fact that our best Christian living happens when we give serious attention and thought to the place that we're going. Unfortunately, we're so often preoccupied with a temporary world, living for things that are right around the corner, that we forget the end of the road that we're going to, the things that will last forever. A church like ours should be transformed by heavenly mindedness. Heavenly mindedness. Some of the things that we preach and even talked about, like even today, you can get really convicted about them. But when you understand them in light of eternity and where we're going, it doesn't become a difficult thing. It becomes an exciting proposition because we're preparing for that. So here's the question. You ever hear this saying, "You're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good"? It's kind of an old cliche, and it's used sometimes to talk about a person who seems unnecessarily spiritual or something. Well, I think really the real problem that we face as Christians is that we are probably more so earthly minded, we're no heavenly good. And I really feel that someday many of us are headed down a path of realizing we're pretty bankrupt heading into eternity. We didn't do as much to invest. This is one problem that my dad has tried to help me with. I graduated from seminary, age 24, something like that. And dad said, "Son, have you started saving for retirement?" I said, "No, I just paid off my seminary bills. I just graduated from seminary." He said, "I'm just saying you should probably start." And he told me that even when I was an undergrad, which seemed kind of silly to me. I'm thinking, I'm not going to retire for how many years? Why is he telling me this? And then a year or two after seminary graduation, I wasn't married yet, and I was thinking about this, and Dad was trying to drop some hints to me. And I did a little calculation online. You can do these calculators, and I realized the major difference that it makes if you start saving for retirement age 3, 4, 5 years earlier at an early stage of life, just a little at a time, the difference that it makes when you actually reach the point of old age when you can't work anymore can be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars only because you started sooner, not because you invested more money. And of course, if you invest more, that changes the paradigm as well. And so that year, I took a few thousand, like $3,000, and I put them in a CD. Now, I didn't keep putting money in after that until recently. But I put it in there. You know, that just sitting there over 10 years grew. And I realized the importance of planning ahead. And for a pastor to talk to Christians in a church about eternity often feels like a father trying to tell his college student's son to start saving for retirement. It seems so out of touch and so distant and far off that it feels irrelevant. But the fact is, every one of you are going to reach a stage in life where the thought occurs, eternity is right around the corner, and I haven't been living for it. And so I hope today to tantalize you a little bit with understanding better what the future holds. I also want you to think about this. Just as real as this platform is, it's not real amazing, but it is real. We got some carpet here, and I'm standing on it. Can you hear that? It's a hardwood surface. It's a real thing. This is a real building. These are real walls. And you are really looking at a real person talking to you right now. At least you look like you are. You're going to get in a real car. You're going to drive to a real house. You're going to eat real food. And you're going to live a real job this week. Just as real as all of those things are, you're going to stand somewhere on a hard surface and look Jesus in the face and get some measure of reward or shame based upon how you conducted your Christian life, living for that moment. And then all of you who know Christ as Savior will enter into the kingdom, and it will be a real kingdom. It's going to be a real place, and life will continue forever. And if you really let that sink in, you understand why you should take the things of this life so very unseriously and give them so very little attention. We give disproportionate attention to the things of this life and such infinitely small attention to eternity. And it's almost going to be like you're going to wake up someday facing retirement. You're going to have 10 bucks in the bank. That's kind of what it's like. You're going to wake up and meet the Lord, and you're going to go into heaven saying, wow, I really blew what could have been for eternity. I'm going to enjoy eternity, but it could have been even better, and eternity is a very long time. So that's why you find me sometimes trying to persuade you to kind of reevaluate life, and what sounds radical sometimes actually isn't very radical. It sounds radical when you're in college to consider putting $200 in the month every in the bank every month, like $200 in the bank every month when I'm 24 years old, that's ridiculous. The things I could do with that money. Well, you won't be saying that when you hit old age. You'll be saying that was the smartest thing I ever did. So, let's talk a little bit about eternity today. In fact, I mean, when you die, what's going to happen to you? Do you have any idea what it's going to be like? My grandma actually thought, I think I've told you this, that she would be a little naked baby flying around with angel wings, like Michelangelo painted on the Sistine Chapel. And Dad taught her, no, not exactly. Now, to her credit, she was actually excited about that. I don't think I could have been excited about that. But that actually is not the case. So let's talk about paradise first. What does the Bible say about paradise? Paradise is a real thing. The word paradise is actually a loan word. What that means is it was not a word originally invented in the Hebrew language. It was borrowed from the Persian language, and it's a word that means an enclosure or a park or a garden of some kind. The Greeks used it to refer to the parks of, and the gardens of the Persian kings. How many of you recall the Hanging Gardens of the Babylonian Empire? Just this massive, elaborate garden that was associated with a royal figure that was to be enjoyed. And that's the word. That's what paradise means. An enclosed garden, especially of royalty or a king, has a Persian background, the word does. The idea fits very well with the Hebrew picture of a garden where the Lord walked in the beginning. Genesis 3:8 talks about this, and then of course all of humankind was excluded from that garden after we sinned. And in that paradise you had things like fruit trees and rivers, or four different rivers specified, and these amazing trees and things to enjoy. God created that Garden of Eden as a paradise. A large but enclosed garden where human beings could enjoy the true pleasures of life and most of all his immediate presence. And that was it was an amazing place. It would have beat every botanical garden in the world. My wife and I have a special little memory on our honeymoon. In the middle of it, we were in Victoria, BC, British Columbia, so far west, just northwest of Washington State. And on Sunday, we went to a church service. This was a very special memory. It was the first Sunday being married, and the pastor asked if I would preach, which he was very hesitant. He said, "I know it's your honeymoon." But we talked about it, and he wanted to have a special day where he was having a big anniversary in his own marriage, like 40 anniversary or something. He was going to preach on longevity in marriage. Then he was going to have me preach about the purpose of marriage. I'm sure it was a great, great message. I'd been married for 6 days. I have the recording. I still haven't gotten the boldness to actually listen to it. Probably be pretty convicted by it. And then he had his single son talk about preparing for marriage. And then we observed the Lord's table on that day, thinking about our marriage to the Lord. And it was just a very special day. And after all that was done, they kind of operated like we do here. They were done at about 3 o'clock or something. So we had the whole rest of the day to ourselves. So we went to Beauchurch Botanical Gardens, which is an international garden. Huge thing. They had a sunken gardens and a rose garden, everything. My grandpa, who has paid thousands of dollars to go to Alaska and all over the world in his retirement, went to the same garden twice on an official tour, and he said every time he went there, it's always packed with people. There's buses of military personnel and senior citizens and all kinds of people trying to get into this park. On that day, we left that church service, we went to the gardens, and we pulled up, and it was threatening to rain. So no one was there. There was one other car in the whole parking lot. I never saw who they were. We had the whole thing to ourselves for several hours. That was pretty fun. But I tell you, the paradise of God, whether you're talking about the Garden of Eden or anything else, would blow your mind. It'd be a garden you'd never want to leave. And the most impressive thing about it will not be all of the natural qualities of it, but the fact that if you walk around in there, you'll find God. And you can talk with him and you can spend time with him because he'll be enjoying his garden too. And that's what it was like in the Garden of Eden. He created this place, this space for enjoyment. He, of course, himself was enjoying it, and he made us to enjoy it with him. When we talk about paradise, there really are three paradises in the Bible. There is the beginning of this world. It was made with a paradise, this garden. It was a fascinating garden. I couldn't prove this stuff, but there are things that scientists and Christian scientists have said, indicating that there seems to have been a canopy of vapor all around the earth. There weren't precipitation cycles where you had massive rainstorms and floods and dry spells. There would have been more like a greenhouse canopy effect all around the world, would have created a greenhouse environment. Plants and animals would all have grown much larger, lived much longer, and been much more productive and amazing. They say tomatoes could have been this big, and animals could have been so much bigger than they are. People were probably much larger than we are today, and everything would have just been perfect. A perfect growing environment, a perfect living environment. Some scientists, Christian scientists, say that in that environment, just breathing would give you a thrill. You would breathe, and then just the qualities of that air would just fill your lungs and be amazing. Just, it would be just an experience just to breathe the air. Today, we breathe so shallow, and there's so much stuff in the air. And it keeps us alive, but they say even that may have been affected. It would have been an amazing place. Then you have a paradise in the world to come. Looking out into the new earth that we're going to talk about today as well, there is a paradise there. In fact, the entire earth seems to be very much like a paradise. So we have that to look forward to. But the paradise that we're probably most interested in right now, and by the way, you could look at Genesis 2 through 3, obviously for the first paradise, Ezekiel 36, 35, about the future paradise. Ezekiel 36, 35. You have these features of the wonderful garden, the presence of God, but then there's this intermediate hidden paradise, and that's the one that is there now. You say, where is it? Where is this paradise? This, we'll talk about where it is in just a minute. This paradise features several things. In the paradise that exists now, there is the presence of God. You also have bodiless spirits of those who are deceased. I know that sounds a little weird to us, but we'll talk about that. It's expansive, and it's also called Abraham's bosom. So let's talk about this here for just a minute. When I say it's expansive, look at Mark 13:27. This paradise, the one that is present now in this intermediate state between the original paradise and the future one, this garden, this place where God is, that's beautiful. Mark 13:27 talks about a time when he's going to come back at the second coming to set up his earthly kingdom. Mark 13:27 says, "And then shall he send his angels," not humans, "and shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven." And it seems like at the time that he comes back and he brings his saints with him, before he does that, he's going to send out all of his angels to bring them all together, which indicates there's going to be a lot of saints in that world, and they're going to be kind of far apart. They're not all going to be huddled together in one place. So it's expansive, this place where the deceased saints are right now. They're bodiless spirits. We'll talk about that a little bit later. It's also called Abraham's bosom. Look in Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16, verse 23. Of course, this is the story of Lazarus and the rich man. Lazarus died and went into hell, and Lazarus is the poor man, rich man went to hell. Lazarus, though, it says in verse 22, we'll go back to there. "Came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. The rich man died also and was buried. And in hell he lift up his eyes, being in torments, and sees Abraham afar off, and Lazarus in his bosom. And he cried and said, Father Abraham, have mercy on me." And this idea of Abraham's bosom and this poor person that died being in Abraham's bosom, what does that mean? When you would sit down together with someone in this period of time, you would sit on the floor, and you would kind of sit around. Often you would recline kind of on your side, and you'd eat kind of like that, reclining on couches or reclining on the floor. You didn't have a table with chairs like we do today. And when you do that, you wouldn't kind of lay head to foot in a big circle. You would kind of lay like this, but then the next person's head would kind of be like right here in front of you, and there would be an overlap effect so you could be closer together. Does that make sense? I could have some people come up and demonstrate that, but that would just be a little bit weird. So you would lay down kind of overlapping each other like this. Remember when Jesus performed the Lord's table in the Passover in the New Testament, and it said that John leaned on his breast? What is that talking about? What that means is he was the person immediately beside him whose head was in front of his chest, because that's how they would lay out in a circle, and he was the guy that was right there. And so what you see here is this poor person died, and he was having table fellowship with Abraham. He was up close to Abraham, which is an amazing thing. And what can you draw from that? Abraham is there. He's in paradise. So that probably also leads us to believe that all deceased saints are there, not just Abraham. But Abraham is there, and he was singled out because he's the guy that everybody was concerned about back then as a Jew. Well, we are Abraham's children and all these kind of things. Well, Abraham's in paradise. He was there. This poor man was there. So if Abraham was there and this poor beggar was there, who else do you think is there? Everybody else who has died, the soul has departed from their body. And they're in this intermediate state, also called paradise. So what is it like? I don't really know. I can tell you, Abraham is there. All other deceased saints are there. They don't have bodies, but you can still see each other and know who each other is. Apparently, you sit around, maybe you eat, because that's what this idea of being in his bosom was what you would do when you would eat. Maybe they're eating, I don't know. What do you eat when you don't have a body? I don't know. Jesus ate in his glorified body. At least they were sitting around, probably talking to each other, getting to know each other. And as I already said, apparently this whole space is very expansive. The rich man saw this, but he saw it from a very far distance. Maybe you can see pretty far when you're in paradise and the spiritual world. And it's also called the paradise. Some people try to dismiss that as, oh, that's just a way to make us be excited. I personally tend to think that it is an actual paradise, that it is actually beautiful, that it is actually either a garden or much like a garden that's very expansive, very impressive. If God is royalty, and he is, right? Wherever he is probably going to be pretty impressive. And if he made a garden in the physical world, seems right that he would want to make another one for us to go to next, because that's where he likes to fellowship. He's probably not going to create a coffee shop to hang out at. He's going to tend to do a garden. That's what God likes. So something that's very paradisical, very expansive, the deceased saints are there without their bodies, but there's interaction, which is kind of neat, because to me it indicates, you go to Hebrews 11, talks about the great hall of faith and the many witnesses. We're going to get to talk to these people and see these people. When we die, we get to go to the beyond, see this paradisical place, and talk to all of these people. And how long did it take for this poor guy who died, this beggar, to see Abraham? I mean, of all people, you'd think we'd have to work his way up in the line. Well, it seems like Abraham was pretty interested in getting to know him. I don't know, maybe he's interested in getting to know me. Or maybe Moses is the one that wants to know me. I don't know. But it's pretty fascinating to think about. And I just think some of us are going to face death or we're going to die and realize we really didn't plan on this very much. We didn't really plan on this very much. What are you going to talk about when you get there? Abraham would say, hey, you know, how was your life? And I'm thinking out loud here. I had a good job. God gave me a good job. Gave me a good job. Oh, that's good. Had a good house. Yeah. How was your house? Oh, yeah, that's right, Abraham. You didn't have a house. Yeah, I was living looking for that city. You know, we're going to get a city. Did you know that? Did you ever hear about that? Some Christians are going to say, no, I never heard about this city. What is a city? Now, if you go to Faith Baptist Church, you can at least say Pastor talked about this city, so you should know about it. But he was looking for a city. All of his life, he was looking for a city. He said no to a lot of things. He left his family to look for this city. And he did give up his son. We talked about the things we sacrificed. Here's a man who has a lot to talk about. And he might sit down with some of us sometimes and realize in paradise, where were you? I was in their world too. And I had someone at work one time make a funny face at me because I said I go to church. And he would say, good for you. Good. What are we going to talk about with these people? Those who were killed, those who suffered for their faith, those who said no to riches. Moses, for instance, said no to the pleasures of this world and identify with the sufferings of the people of God. They might be a little shocked at some of the conversations they've had with people going into the beyond. Like, well, you just didn't get it, did you? Well, welcome. If you ever need someone to talk to you, come and talk to me. We're glad you're here. Boy, isn't Jesus great? Because, you know, not only was I the kind of person who gave my son, but I did other things too. I wasn't the world's greatest person. So I don't know exactly what we're going to talk about in that middle place, but it's going to be pretty neat. If you look in 2 Corinthians 5:8, you see that it's also called being with the Lord. To be absent from the body is to be present, not just with Abraham and all the deceased saints, but you'll be present with the Lord, and the Lord is there. Philippians 1:23 talks about being present with Christ, same idea. And that is the most impressive part of this. You die, you leave your body for a time, and you're immediately in the presence of the Lord and all of these deceased saints in a paradise environment. That's going to be pretty neat. A garden is what it seems to be. You have personal interaction with one another, and I mean, seriously, that could go on for a long time. You'd always have someone to talk to. So, when we talk about this, when do you go to paradise? When do you go to paradise? And I think the answer to that is immediately. Luke 23:43. Jesus said to the thief on the cross, "Verily I say unto you, today you will be with me in paradise." And that is an amazing thing. By the way, for our Catholic friends, here is a person who is actually dying for heinous crimes, crimes that deserved the death penalty. He receives salvation by faith through Jesus Christ, having done no good works in his life. Nothing. And not only does Jesus save him, and say, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." Apparently, there's no purgatory involved either. You see where I'm going with this? Today you'll be with me in paradise. You say, "Well, technically, you could have gone to purgatory for a couple of hours before the day was over." Well, okay, a guy who committed heinous crimes, probably if he was going to do purgatory, would have to be there for a while. And Jesus says, "No, today you're going to be with me in paradise. Whenever you pass away." Also, Paul says, 2 Corinthians 5:8, "We are confident, I say, and willing rather to be absent from the body," the soul departing from the body, "and to be present with the Lord." The moment your soul departs, you're with the Lord. You're in this intermediate state with the deceased saints, with the Lord, in this paradise that is expansive and impressive. So immediately seems to be the right answer. And again, fellowship with Christ is the most important feature of this intermediate state. If you can think to yourself, "Well, I get to see Jesus someday," and it doesn't move you, you really need to spend some time reflecting. Because that is an amazing thing. To get to see the Lord. You ever... A healthy imagination is a good thing. Do you ever visualize, do you ever stop and just in your mind imagine what that's going to be like? What will his face look like? And try to kick out all the actors and paintings and pictures you've ever seen because they have nothing to do with it. What is Jesus going to look like? You can read Revelation 1 a little bit. You can read some of Ezekiel chapter 1. You can read Isaiah 6. A lot of the Psalms. Psalm 23 is helpful. And just meditate on it. And pretend you're looking at his face. What thoughts will go through your mind? What apologies will you want to say? I mean, what's going to happen to you? And it should be a very moving thing just to meditate on that. It's a very healthy thing to do. And you'll get to see him. You'll get to see him. I think the people who've thought on it long and hard, the people who've made sacrifices, the people who've given their lives to serve him, to become Christ-like, and to help others to do that. You've spent time in the Word. You've memorized the Word. You've prayed a lot. I think he's going to look exactly like you think he's going to look like. I couldn't put it on a picture. I couldn't draw it. I couldn't. But there's an impression. And when I see him, I know it's going to be like that. And those who walk with God are probably all having the same impression, and none of us can put it down. We just know. And I don't think we'll have anything to say. I think we'll be very quiet and just amazed that we're even there. You can have the things of this world. So that's paradise. Any quick questions about paradise? In particular, Brother Cherian? Luke 23:43 mentions paradise, and Mark 13:27 mentions paradise, and Luke 16:23 mentions paradise. A couple of the other references reference what happens to us immediately after we die, which is all the same time frame. What's that? The Greek word, I didn't actually print out the Greek word or write it down. I'd have to look that up again. Let's talk about heaven. Heaven is, it probably refers to more than just paradise, but includes paradise. It is the invisible realm, you could call it the beyond, where God is, which either includes paradise or is paradise. Jennifer, you had a question? Yes, paradise, again, maybe summarizing it this way, it's a recurring theme that seems to have a prominent place in the plan of God and the way that he expresses himself and the way that he interacts with people. He made everything and he put us in a paradise. He was in that paradise. It's a garden, an oppressive garden. And it seems that even though he expelled us out of it because of sin, and even though there's still another one in the future that we have to look forward to, I mean, this is something that God apparently really likes. He actually has one that's invisible, that is not seen, that we actually get to participate in before the future actual physical one comes back again. He really is insistent on this being the way that we interact with him. Heaven. So many angles to this idea. Of course, heaven, you have different layers of heaven. You have the earth, the terrestrial sphere, then you have heaven being the immediate sky, the first heaven. Then you have the second heaven, the solar system, which is expanseless. When we talk about heaven, we're usually in the scripture talking about the third heaven. Paul talks about it as the third heaven in Corinthians, and that is, it's the space, if you can call it that, that is beyond the second heaven, the solar system as far as that goes, which is gazillions of light years. Who knows how far that goes? But beyond that appears to be where the third heaven is, and it's probably where paradise is in all of this. We talk about it as though it's invisible because it bridges the physical and the spiritual world. It probably is actually a place beyond the solar system and the galaxies, but it also is a spiritual place. And again, that's hard for us to figure out. And that'll get a little more confusing when we look at the new heaven and the new earth and the new Jerusalem. Where is heaven? It is in the invisible realm, 2 Corinthians 4:18. Let's look at that. 2 Corinthians 4:18. He says, Paul says, while we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. And this is so important for us to really meditate on and get, because we are inundated every day. We're pounded with visible things. We are so disoriented to physical, material things. When the fact is, all of the things of this physical life are just like cardboard props up on a high school drama stage getting pushed back and forth by drama students. And at the end of the drama, you realize, yeah, that was a nice drama, but that wasn't real life. It wasn't even a really good drama. And that is what this world is like. And we give so much attention to the physical things that we see, not realizing just beyond, in the beyond, is a spiritual world, and that's where we're going, and that's what lasts forever, and that's what we're living for. We don't think very spiritually. And we would do well to understand this and to pray about this and understand this a little bit better. We are living for the unseen things, the invisible realm. It is a realm far beyond all things. I've mentioned this, Ephesians 4. Nine through 10. Talks about Jesus after he died on the cross. Verse 9, now that he ascended, what is it that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended far up above all heavens, that he might fill all things. It's a little parenthesis here, and a quick little Greek note. When it says, now that he's descended first into the lower parts of the earth, the best understanding I can have of this as I've studied the Greek and the different ways that Greek is used, when it says the lower parts of the earth, it's what you call a genitive construction. When you have a word described by of and then something else, it could be a lot of things. It could tell you where something comes from. It could tell you the reason for something. It could tell you all sorts of things. Sometimes what it's talking about is what you would call apposition. Does anyone know what apposition is? Where's Julie when you need her, right? I really believe this is a genitive of apposition, meaning this: the lower parts, namely the earth. If I said, my wife, Sarah, that's the idea. My wife, comma, which is Sarah, comma, and then I move on with my thought. I think that's what's going on here. The genitive use, you know, it's a Greek explanation, is this. He descended to the lower parts, namely the earth, and then he ascended up far above all things into the heavens beyond the heavens. He came down to the earth, and he gave gifts to the church. Then he went up to the heavens, far up above all heavens. So whatever heavens you're talking about, he went far beyond those things. And so he ascended far above all heavens, the sky, the solar system, the galaxies, that he may fulfill all things. Does that make sense? So this paradise, this invisible realm, is beyond all heavens. First Thessalonians 4:15 through 17, Paul says, this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent those who are asleep, who are dead and deceased. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven. He's going to come down from where he went to, far up above all heavens. He's going to descend from heaven, again, with a shout and with the voice of the archangel and with the trump of God. And the dead in Christ shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with him in the clouds, and so shall we ever be with the Lord. And so it's at that moment, I think it's accurate to say, you put the pieces together, that's when he sends, remember, all the angels out, he collects all the deceased, and at that moment, he comes down, and when he does, he already has his glorified body, because now we're moving back into the terrestrial world. to move on with his plan for this earth. And the deceased saints would include Abraham and so forth, will come up from the grave. They'll get their bodies back. They'll be transformed free from sin like Jesus' body. And those of us who are still alive, if we're still alive, our body will be transformed and we'll all go back to be with the Lord and we'll continue with him that way, whether that be on earth or in heaven. And we'll remain in that state. So it's at that point when he comes down out of heaven that all of us will get our physical bodies back, renewed, free from sin, and eternal. And in that condition, we will ever be with the Lord. So it seems that we'll actually be having our physical body in heaven then at that point as well. And of course, certainly possible because he has his physical body in heaven right now too. Which again indicates to me that though it is the invisible realm, there's still a physical aspect to it. Does that make sense? I know it's hard for us to understand. But you get to go there. That's got to be pretty exciting. I hope you understand you're not going to be little angels just flapping around, tooting on little horns or something. It's going to be an expansive place where God is. We won't have our bodies. We will get our bodies back. Revelation 19, 1 through 2. John writes, and he says, "After these things, I heard a great voice of much people in heaven saying, Alleluia, salvation and glory and honor and power unto the Lord our God. For true and righteous are his judgments. He hath judged the great whore, which did corrupt the earth with her fornication, and hath avenged the blood of his servants at her hand." And here you see all the saints of all time just gathered around praising him. There will be probably many occasions of praising the Lord around his throne, and will all sound good at that point. It'll be loud. It'll be just amazing. We will not probably always be always at the throne singing. We'll live a life and everything, but we'll often be at the throne praising him. We won't be able to get enough of that. So you see this also going on in heaven. It's in the invisible realm. It is beyond all things. And another interesting note is that Matthew 6:10, part of the Lord's Prayer, or the model prayer, says we should pray with this principle in mind: thy kingdom come, thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven. In that place right now and forever, God is never disobeyed. His will is always done. That's a nice place to be too. What is in heaven? And so many things. I'll just list them here. God is there. There's a temple there. There's a throne where God is. Countless angels of all kinds. And you study the book of Revelation, you see all kinds of angels. You study the Bible. There are seraphim and teraphim and all kinds of them. There are all kinds of creatures that some of them have four faces. And if you study those kind of creatures in Ezekiel and Revelation, they're not even the same. Like in Ezekiel, there's four different faces on a couple of things. Then you go to Revelation, you say, oh, this is the same thing as Ezekiel. But wait, no, it's not. This one has a couple faces this one doesn't have. And then there are these things called elders. And a lot of commentators have exhausted a lot of ink trying to figure out what these elders are and if they represent the church in Israel. You know what I say to that? I personally think they're just another angelic being that looks like an aged person. There are so many different kinds, not just to say so many myriads of angels. I think there's all kinds of angels. I mean, look at people. How many kinds of people did God make? A lot. How many kinds of animals did God make? A lot. And how many different kinds of angels do you think God made? Probably a lot. And even within the kinds, there's probably a lot of variation there as well. I am personally, you know, I'm careful. You don't want to spiritualize secular things too much. But when I read things like the Chronicles of Narnia or the Lord of the Rings, these kind of allegories, and you see all these different kinds of beings and creatures, the thing that fascinates me about that is it reminds me of what I think eternity is actually going to be like. When you fuse the spiritual and the physical together, you will see all the beings of all time that God has created, and they all get to interact with each other, and that's pretty neat. Now, it won't be like in the stories. It'll be the way it really is, whatever those creatures and angels are. Yeah, I tell you, the world we have to look forward to, still as foggy as it is so impressive and so stunning and so tantalizing and amazing. Why do we spend time with the things of this world that are going to go up in a puff of smoke? The world we're getting ready for is in a very impressive place. Just the temporary paradise is impressive. What is the connection of heaven to our life now? Philippians 3:20 is an interesting verse that we really need to spend time thinking about as Christians. Paul says, our conversation, actually the word makes more sense if we translate it, citizenship. Our citizenship is in heaven, from whence we look for the Savior. So because we're alive, we're waiting for him to come there. We already talked about that, to come back here and set up his kingdom on this world. But right now, if you know Christ as Savior, your citizenship is there. You have 1 Peter 2:11, Peter writes, dear beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. The idea is aliens and foreigners. That's what he's saying. He's saying, realize, you really have to realize that the world you're living in right now, this world, this physical world right now, you're just a stranger. You don't belong here. Everything about your situation is temporary and transient. Your passport is not earth. Your citizenship is not this world. It's that one beyond all solar systems, from where Jesus is going to come from and where you're going to go when you die, and eventually where you're going to get to go back to with your physical body. It's where all the deceased saints are. And how should you conduct yourself? I was talking to someone recently, and they're having a challenge with another person, and the one person said, well, you don't understand, you have to put up with me because that's my culture. That's how we do things in my culture. And the other person said, well, I have my culture, and you need to be respectful to that. And let me just take that silly scenario and explain it in this way. Here we are in this world. But we seem often as Christians so unconcerned about living out a Christ-like culture. We should be going through this life and people think we're a little unusual, but we say, you know what, that's not my culture. My culture is a heavenly culture. I belong to heaven. I belong to God. And there are ways that you live in that country. Have you been there? No, I haven't been there yet, but that's where I belong. And that's where I'm going, and I'm just visiting here. How do they live in that culture? Read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7. And read the whole Bible, and you'll find out. And I think sometimes people look at us, whether it's visibly or just our attitudes, this, our priorities, and we don't look like we're from heaven. In all ways, and we should really consider, am I really representing well where I really belong? That's worth thinking about. It's really like the kid who grows up and thinks that, boy, to make it in this world, I want to get a lot of money, and I want to be able to go to the candy store whenever I can and buy candy. And then you grow up and realize that that was really not very important. But to a young kid to be able to go to the candy store and just buy candy whenever you want, but that's living, right? You grow up a little bit bigger and you're like, oh, actually, no, I want to be able to go to Toys R Us or GameStop whenever I want and buy anything I want. That's really where it's at right there. I don't need the candy store. And you grow up a little bit more and you're, oh, actually, no, to really live, you want to get a really nice, cool car or get a really nice job and be able to shop downtown. What's the really fancy place downtown that everyone likes to go and buy their clothing? Chelsea District. I want to go down there and buy all this stuff. Am I right? Is that a place to buy expensive things? No? What is the place to go buy expensive things then? Where's the Fifth Avenue? I'm sorry, your pastor's out of touch. You can tell I don't go there. It's not wrong to go there. I'm just saying where we're investing our resources and what we think is so important, it really, folks, is no different. I mean, the candy store is going to go up in smoke along with Acura and Cadillac and BMW and everything. It's all going to go up in the same pile of ashes. So all I am trying to do sometimes as pastors encourage us to just kind of speed up the whole growth process and learn to look past all this stuff and just be done with it already and focus on what really matters, eternity. You'll never look at me with dirty looks then if I try real hard now. You might look at me with funny looks now, but then you'll say, yeah, I see what you're trying to say. This is much more real than all of that, and it actually lasts forever. So these are things we need to think about. This is where our citizenship is. Let's wrap up by talking about the new heaven and the new earth. This is a very fast survey of this stuff. What is the new heaven and the new earth? This is not something that is currently present. So we've talked about paradise, that garden-like, expansive place where all the deceased are without bodies right now, but the Lord is there with his body. We have fellowship together. It's beyond all heavens. The Lord's going to come back from there someday, and all the deceased saints will come back and get their bodies, and we'll all go back with him. And then when he comes down to set up his kingdom, we'll come back and rule with him. Then we'll go back again. And then, at the end of all time, he is going to destroy this world. That's the pile of ashes I keep talking about. I like Faith Baptist Church's building. It's a real blessing, but it will disappear then, if it makes it that far. Everything will be gone. God is the creator of the heavens and the earth. Psalm 102, verse 25 says, of old you did lay the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. So then, it is entirely appropriate that once he's finished his purpose for this created, expansive world and universe, that he can dispose of it and make something else. My children do this all the time. They're always making new things, pulling out the paper out of the craft bucket and cutting this up and coloring on this and folding this and gluing that and taping. They make all of these things. And the next week, half of them are in the trash. And they're making new things and doing all this kind of stuff. You know, God is the original creator. He's the God who makes things out of nothing. We just make stuff out of the stuff he made. He makes things out of nothing. He made everything. And when he's done with it, just as easily as at the end of the service, I'm going to take my sermon notes right here. I'm going to throw them in the trash can. I'm not going to keep them. He's going to do the same thing with this whole world that we're selling ourselves to. He's going to take it, get rid of it, and make a new one. And it's very easy for him to do. He can do that in moments. These are powerful thoughts to really get our minds around. Psalm 102, verse 26, that next verse in Psalm 102. They will all wear out like a garment. Thou changest them like raiment, and they pass away. These are like little boys' jeans. I buy my boys brand new jeans. I mean, you can always pass clothing down in a family of five children, except for the pants. The pants don't work because by the time they're 2 months old, what's going on? I don't care if you buy the best brands and the most reinforced knees, they always have holes in the knees. Always. And that's what this world is like. I mean, the whole thing. You can put the best engineers on the job, but that building is going to fall apart. You can make the most quality car you can think of. I was reading this week about the new Aston Martin something or other. It's a pretty cool car. You buy that car, it's going to fall apart. And this world is going to be disposed of when he's done with it. So don't take it too seriously. It's just a piece of junk. It's going to fall apart. God, though, will create, and this is what you want to plan on, because this is where you want to put the eggs in this basket. You want to buy the car that doesn't get old. You want to buy the thing that lasts forever. You want to invest in the thing that doesn't go away, right? God will create a new heaven and a new earth that's so incredible that no one will ever remember the old one. All remembrance of the first one will vanish. You won't even remember this building, probably. You know, that computer game you want, or that piece of clothing, or whatever the thing is, a car, the house, anything. You won't even remember it, so stop being so worried about it. Really. Isaiah 65:17. Behold, God says, I will create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. I mean, it sounds like the same thing to me. So when you see repetition, what's the point? Really get this. I mean, don't let this thought pass out of your mind till it's stuck really good and has clung on to your decision-making and your priorities. This is not information. This is transformation. Let this settle in. You won't even remember this. It won't even come to mind. The things you thought you really had to have as a teenager and you never got. I really wanted a 1964 and a half Mustang when I turned 16. I really did. My parents are really thinking about letting me buy one of all this. Kind of surprising looking back at it now. But they were really considering letting me buy one of these old classic cars. And then they decided, no, save my money for college. I look back, I really thought it would be cool, really neat. I never got it. And you know what? I could care less now. Or I could have spent $10,000 on it. What are you really having to have in this world? Do you realize it's going to go away? Like the candy that the 3-year-old kid really thought they had to have. It really will mean nothing. It won't even come into mind. And yet we find ourselves grasping at things and loving things that really, quite frankly, we just got to think about this a little more. I say, oh, Pastor, doesn't God give us all things richly to enjoy? Probably half of you have already thought about this. He does. So here's the question. Which ones do you want to enjoy the most? Me? The ones that last forever. Does that make sense? I mean, you still have to make value decisions, value judgments. Okay, so you're not even going to think about them in the future. So many things that portray this same idea. It's all over the Bible. I'll just illustrate it by going through this information fast. Scripture gives considerable attention to the passing away of the old order. Again, this repetition is important, speaking of a future time when heaven and earth will disappear. Isaiah 34:4, 51:6, Matthew 24:35, Revelation 21:2. 1 John 2:17, a number of times, and we know this passage, says the world is passing away. The world is passing away. The world is passing away. Hebrews 1:11, Psalm 102, we looked at it, Isaiah 51. They are going to get old like a piece of clothing. That's all that it is. 2 Peter 3:10 and Isaiah 34:4. The heavens will pass away with a loud noise, the elements will be dissolved with fire, the earth and the works that are upon it will be burned up. So total destruction will occur. 2 Peter 3:12, looking for and hastening unto the coming of the day of God, where the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. I've been reading about the table elements recently in my personal reading time. It's all going to burn up. All the molecules are going to go apart, all of them. It's all going to go away. And he says, looking forward to it. Looking forward to it. Why would you look forward to it? The less you've invested in the future world, the more you're interested in this one going away because you don't have anything here. But the people who've invested a lot in this world are not looking forward to this. They want to keep this life and this world as long as possible. That's a good question for yourself to ask. Am I looking forward to that new world or not quite? Where are my investments? 2 Peter 3:13, nevertheless, we according to his promise look for new heavens and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. That's what we should be living for. He's going to make a new one. And then you have this new Jerusalem. And by the world, the new heaven and the new earth, it's going to be a sky, it's going to be a world, just like we live in now, just without sin, everything is going to be right, it's going to be a worldwide paradise. You get to live life. We'll probably work jobs. We'll probably have different levels of government office and roles and relationships. There won't be any crime. If you want to go on vacation, you can go on vacation anywhere in the world, see it all. And we'll probably all be wanting to make regular trips to go to worship the Lord. But that won't be the only thing. It'll be a real, actual place. And the way you will enjoy that world is affected by how you live this one. The New Jerusalem. What is this New Jerusalem? It's a new city that will be the center of worship and activity in the new heaven and earth. So everything gets destroyed, and then you see this city. Galatians 4:26 says, "But Jerusalem, which is above, is free." What is above? There is a city, best as I can tell, in heaven. So in the beyond, there's a city. And it's free. It's free from sin. It's free from pain. It doesn't have any of the problems that plague every other city in this world. And it is the mother of us all who believe. So it's not the physical Jerusalem in this world that we should all be drawn to. It's that one. That's the one that Abraham was looking for. He left Ur of the Chaldees, that Sumerian massive city. Where's the city I'm looking for? I don't think it's in this world. And he lived his life preparing for that city. And it's there. I don't think Abraham's in it yet. It seems like he's in paradise, but he's not in that city yet, best as I can tell. You've got this city. It's a new kind of city. It's unlike any other city we've seen here. There's a lot said about it in Revelation 21 and 22, if you want to look into that. Hebrews 12, 22 through 23. Talks about it, and who will live in that city? Myriads of all kinds of angels, deceased Old Testament saints made perfect, and deceased church age saints. You can look at that passage and study that out, but it's all there. I go back to the stories that I talked about, Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia. One of the things that strikes me about, you see all these kind of beings and creatures, that the New Jerusalem is going to be like that. You're going to have it all there, all the beings he ever made. That's pretty neat. That's pretty impressive. Then you got the paradise and the world to live in. It sounds like a fantasy world. And isn't it true that in all of our hearts, saved or lost, there's a desire for that? There's a longing for that. Why? Because we were made for that. Satan does his best to get us distracted from that and get us focused on this piddly stuff everywhere. It's trash. And we need to be living for that. There are crowds of people gathering even now, getting ready for that in the beyond. And they're waiting for us to come along. It's the city that Old Testament saints were looking for. Abraham looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Certainly not the Tower of Babel and all these earthly cities. John 14, 2-3. In my Father's house, Jesus said, are many mansions. I think that's referring to the city. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again. And you see the theme of him coming back again unto myself, that where I am, there you may continue to be also. This idea of a mansion, let me just set the record straight. He's not talking about a Beverly Hills mansion out on a hill somewhere. Maybe there will be houses like that. I don't know. But that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the city. If you look at it, it's a big, massive cube. And if you understand how houses were built back in those days, you would keep adding rooms on. And what he's talking about is, I believe his throne is there in that city, and there are so many rooms in that city. What he's guaranteeing is all of you are going to have a room in that city. It's not perfect illustration, but the best I could come up with this week is this. Imagine that the city is a massive tower down in Manhattan somewhere. And it's almost like he's saying, look, you're all going to have a studio in my tower. And you'll have immediate one-button access from your elevator to the throne, all of you. And if it weren't so, I wouldn't have told you. I'm going to bring you into my place. I'm going to bring you into my house. And you'll have a place like Abraham and everybody else. Isn't that exciting? hope I didn't dash anybody's hopes of this Beverly Hills palace. You're going to be with him in that place. You're going to get your own spot. And then you get the whole world, too. I mean, to enjoy and experience the whole thing. It's an amazing thing. This city, and it's going to come down. Revelation 21:2, and I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. This is given in the book of Revelation to encourage people who are suffering for their faith, who seem to have lost everything in this world, to remind them that you haven't lost everything. You haven't lost anything. Someday, this place that Jesus is preparing is going to come out of this physical, spiritual, whatever, far beyond heaven. We're going to come down. We're going to be on the new earth that he makes, and we're going to watch the city come down. And really, best as I can explain it, the spiritual and the physical will be fused forever. There won't be a distinction, it seems. And all beings of life, free from sin, will have a place there, be coming and going. The gates will be open at all times of day. There'll be no night there. There'll be no crime, no problems. And it will be an amazing forever existence. And if you know Christ as Savior, you get to enjoy all of that. And I don't think we think about that enough. Look forward to it. Live for it. Make decisions based upon it. And may the things of this world grow strangely dim.